listening to Louisiana Considered, a new daily show about South Louisiana from WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Patrick Madden, and thank you for being with us today. And on today's show, we'll be talking with the Advocate's Blake Patterson about his story on Baton Rouge's oldest black cemetery, which has fallen into disrepair. And later on, we'll hear about the latest on Louisiana's vaccine rollout. But first, we're going to turn our attention to the historic rise in homicides nationwide in 2020. Jeff Asher, who is a data analyst here in New Orleans and used to work for NOPD as a crime analyst, co-authored a big piece this weekend in The Intercept. Asher found that 2020 represented just a huge, huge increase since records started being collected in 1960. And also related to this is the impact we've seen here in Louisiana. Jeff Asher, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me. Next time, maybe we'll do it in studio.
Hopefully soon we'll be able to do this in person. Jeff, your story in The Intercept basically shows that 2020 saw just a historic rise nationwide in homicides in big cities, small cities, here in Louisiana. And as it explains, there are a lot of complex reasons why this is happening, but can you just talk about sort of what seem to be some of the big factors driving this?
Yeah, I mean, the big factors seem to be at least the pandemic, big picture, things like the economic issues, the mental health, the physical, the medical stresses of the pandemic. The economic stresses of the pandemic with stimulus money running out and people losing their jobs and people losing their livelihoods. And then in a lot of places, there was this big surge over the summer. And there's a tendency, I think, to say, oh, well, police must have stopped policing. The protests must have driven it. There must have been some change in how proactive policing was happening. And at least as far as we can tell, this rise was so big and in so many places, and in the places that we've seen it, it wasn't inherently a change in policing. It really does seem to be more related to a change in police legitimacy, or a lack of people trusting the police, or a decrease in the amount of people that were trusting the police. That is sort of this neutral arbiter. And you saw this just incredible increase. We saw it in New Orleans. We saw it in New York City. We saw it in Portland. We saw it in Omaha, Nebraska. And it's the type of thing that I think it's tempting to blame on these hyper-local explanations of something happened in my neighborhood, in my city, and that caused it. But it really does seem to be these big picture national trends that really are the driving factors behind the increase.
And when you talk about those national trends, I mean, you talk about the increase in the availability of firearms, basically that more people have guns. Can you talk about, and obviously there are other roles, but what role do folks think that has had so far?
Again, it's a very difficult thing to really pin down causally, but we know that there was a surge in firearm purchases throughout 2020, especially early on in the pandemic. We know that with firearms, incidents that maybe wouldn't have become fatal became fatal, especially early in the pandemic. There was an increase in murder, and that would make sense that things like domestic violence that might not have ordinarily turned fatal with the introduction of more firearms, you would see an increase in murders from that. It's really hard to say exactly how all of these pieces fit together, but it does certainly seem that the addition of the surge of firearm sales acted sort of like an accelerant, where you had all of this perfect storm of other factors contributing, and you throw a ton of firearms on top of that, both legal and illegal firearms, and you're going to have increasing gun violence. And that's really what we see throughout the country.
And Jeff, obviously, we're still in the pandemic right now, and it will take a lot of time to just parse out all the different ways that this has had an impact on people. Is there any sense yet, it's early on, the data is early, but the role the pandemic has played in this increase of homicides and gun violence?
mean, it's clear that it has played a role. The exact relationship and causality there, I think, is really hard to nail down. We basically have the ability to tell that this trend occurred. That's sort of the limit of our ability in terms of analysis. We can come up with assertions and use data to suggest that there's potential explanations out there. But for really understanding why it happened, we took a shot at it with the best available data. For really understanding why it happened, though, you can't quite understand from the available data, unfortunately.
Great. Well, thank you, Jeff, for joining us today. You can read Jeff's story in The Intercept. Jeff is a data analyst here in New Orleans, and he also is a contributing columnist for NOLA.com. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Patrick Madden here on WWNO and WRKF. Inmates at prisons in Mississippi and Louisiana were among the thousands who went without heat or water during last week's winter storm. From our partner station, Mississippi Public Broadcasting, Becca Schimmel reports on what offenders faced while waiting for the thaw.
Keeping cool during the summer is a common challenge in the region's prisons, but the unprecedented cold left correctional staff unprepared. Mississippi's Parchman Prison temporarily lost heat in one dorm. Inmates were moved while repairs were made, according to a statement from Department of Corrections Commissioner Burl Kane. At Marshall County Correctional, a gas line froze, which shut down the kitchen. Across the state at Wilkinson County Correctional Facility, Mitzi Magleby's fiancé told her he was freezing. Her partner is an inmate at the facility. Magleby doesn't believe corrections officers turned the heat up enough to make up for the unprecedented cold.
He's cold. He's cold. Cold showers. Cold everything. But other than that, he seems to be okay.
Wilkinson is a private prison run by Management and Training Corporation. A spokesperson says the heat is working and any inmates who have requested additional blankets have received them. In neighboring Louisiana, inmates at Caddo Correctional Center in Shreveport went without water for multiple days. Caddo Sheriff Steve Prater spoke about the conditions at a press conference last week.
We have barely a trickle of water out there, and there's no way to flush toilets except on a rotating basis by dorm, so it's very uncomfortable out there for the inmates. They have very little heat out there.
Shreveport emergency crews had no snow removal equipment to use to combat the winter storm, making it difficult to get to areas without water. I'm Becca Schimmel.
And again, that was Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Becca Schimmel reporting. And it's Louisiana Considered. I'm Patrick Madden, and you're listening on WWNO and WRKF. And this weekend, The Advocate reported that Baton Rouge's oldest Black burial ground is in disrepair. Broken headstones, crumbling tombs, six-foot-tall forest of weeds. The story of Sweet Olive Cemetery was reported by Advocate journalist Blake Patterson. Blake, first of all, thank you for joining us today. And can you just start off by telling us about Sweet Olive Cemetery and who is buried there?
Yeah, the Sweet Olive Cemetery at one point was the only Black burial ground in the city's limits. Historians think that given its location on the what used to be the countryside, it originated as a burial ground for enslaved people. But the first historical record of it is in 1898 when it was purchased by some Black Baptist charitable groups. And it served for some time as a potter's field for poor and indigent Black people. But there are a number of pretty prominent people buried there. The Reverend Washington Taylor, the father of Gardner C. Taylor. He spent decades as a pastor at Mount Zion Baptist Church. He's buried there. There are also headstones issued by the U.S. government going as far back as for World War I veterans. There's thought to be around 5,000 people buried there, but it's been difficult to verify given the conditions the cemetery is in.
And Blake, can you just tell us sort of how, and obviously this was decades in the making, but how this cemetery fell into such disrepair?
Yeah, the conditions at Sweet Olive are pretty gut-wrenching. As I wrote in my story, there are some grave sites where you can see fully exposed human remains. And, you know, Sweet Olive Cemetery, it looks like it has struggled financially from its inception. I mean, some of the earliest newspaper articles talk about the need for financial backing. And so pleased to the city asking for them to help them financially. Unlike some cemeteries, there's no perpetual care fund here. And a lot of the people buried there have since been disconnected from their descendants. Since the 1970s, it's been under the care of a nonprofit. But when I spoke with its president, W.T. Winfield, he basically said they have no money and are working on prayers, hope, and volunteers.
Blake, it seems like this is something where the government, or at least some of the city's big nonprofits, could step in. I mean, what is your sense about either why that hasn't happened or whether that could happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the people I spoke with, a woman named Fairley Jackson, the head of Preserve Louisiana, pointed out that, within a mile, there's a cemetery called Magnolia Cemetery. And there's also, there's a handful of cemeteries over there. But Magnolia Cemetery has been under the care of Baton Rouge's Parks and Rec Agency since 1947. And so any city-owned cemetery is their responsibility. So there's some talk of perhaps the city, acquiring Sweet Olive and, putting it under the care of the Parks Agency. And I'm told that costs about $20,000 a year to keep up, but it's still early days. I'm not really sure where that's going to go.
And Blake, in your reporting, you mentioned that there's a historic preservation firm here in New Orleans, Row 10, that is doing some pro bono research to help the cemetery in order to get it placed on the National Register of Historic Places. Can you tell us about this effort and what that would do in terms of helping the cemetery?
Yeah, Row 10 is really building off the research of a Lafayette historian named Anne Mahoney, who wrote a dissertation on the cemetery. Getting cemeteries this sort of recognition is quite difficult, but when I spoke to folks at Row 10, they highlighted, what is unique about the cemetery, which are its one aspect of that are its headstones, which, some of them are hand-carved, 100 years old. I'm told that, if they get on the historic registry, it doesn't mean that they'll get, any enhanced funding, but it does help as a resume builder, in applying for grants and getting that recognition that you need.
And finally, Blake, you also sort of mentioned the work of a group of volunteers who've been really helpful in cleaning up this gravesite. Can you just tell us about them?
Yeah, I really focused on a woman named Marquita Cottenham who moved here from California. And she was telling me how her grandma raised her to love cemeteries. And on one of her first visits to Sweet Olive, she stumbled upon a human skull, and her, 7-year-old daughter was with her. And that was sort of a jarring experience. And that really motivated her to kickstart her cleanup efforts. So she holds regular cleanups. Her group's called Preserve Sweet Olive Cemetery. I think their next one is March 13th. She's also hoping to raise money to be able to repair some of these grave sites, to put in a new fence and at least put headstones at all the sites, even if they can't identify the person that say, rest in peace.
Great. Well, thank you, Blake Patterson, journalist at The Advocate. And you can read Blake's story at theadvocate.com. Blake, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Louisiana Considered here on WWNO and WRKF. Listening to Louisiana Considered here on WWNO and WRKF. I'm Patrick Madden. And now we're going to find out the latest on the vaccine rollout here in Louisiana. Today, for the first time, all K-12 teachers will be eligible as well as some other groups. Joining us to give us updates on the vaccine distributions, WWNO's Aubrey Yuhas and WRKF's Capital Access reporter Paul Braun. Aubrey and Paul, thank you guys for being here today.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, Patrick.
Arby, starting with you, can you just give us what you know so far about which teachers will be eligible to receive the vaccine?
Sure. So we know that we're looking at about 167,000, you know, people that fall into this broader educator category statewide. So those are people that are serving on site in K through 12 schools, whether they're public or private, but also people who work in childcare centers. And, you know, this is everybody, not just people who are, you know, interfacing with children and teaching, but also janitors, bus drivers, cafeteria workers. There are plenty of people who have been on site who have already been eligible because they're older or because they are considered, you know, a healthcare kind of person. So school nurses and occupational therapists and people like that. But, you know, this is a whole big bucket of people, and it's really going to hopefully, you know, alleviate some fears for educators. At the same time, we're not expecting all of those 167,000 people to sign up right away. In a call with reporters last week, Superintendent of Education Cade Brumley said that based on surveys and kind of preliminary conversations, he thinks about 50% of eligible educators will be looking to sign up. And here in New Orleans, a survey that they did found that about 63% of their employees are looking to get vaccinated right away.
Thank you, Aubrey. And Paul, you've been covering the governor during this process. I mean, this seems like this is one of the next big sort of rollouts for Edwards. We've also had a lot of serious weather, though, recently. Is there any sense on if that's going to cause any delays or problems with the vaccine distribution here in Louisiana?
Absolutely. I mean, vaccine distributors across the state are dealing with, you know, the highest allocation of doses that they've ever had this week, but they're also sort of working through a backlog of shipments and doses that are just arriving now that should have been there last week, but were delayed, of course, because of poor weather conditions across the country. Many shipments didn't leave centralized distribution locations in other states. It wasn't just issues transporting them around here in Louisiana. And Dr. Joseph Cantor of the Department of Health, he acknowledged that this is going to be a really heavy lift for vaccine providers this week, and said it could take, you know, a week, 10 days, maybe 2 weeks for providers to work through this backlog and address some of the issues that sort of arose from the weather.
That's it's very interesting, especially considering that this next step is going to be such a big part of the effort. Aubrey, turning back to you, I mean, do we have any details yet on how the state is planning to bring in teachers for vaccinations, or who they're going to be working with?
Yeah, so, you know, Superintendent of Education Cade Brumley said that there's been a lot of coordination going on between local school districts and also, you know, individual childcare operators to really partner with different healthcare entities and to try to, you know, get the ball rolling very early, doing kind of, you know, pre-sign-up work, gathering information to register teachers so that when the doses became available and there was this green light, they could get going right away. Now, as Paul was just saying, things are going to be a little bit slower than what was expected. There is this backlog, and at least here in New Orleans, the district has really cautioned, you know, just because you're eligible, it doesn't mean you're going to get the vaccine right away. You got to kind of wait your turn, take a deep breath. It's going to come, but there's going to be probably a little bit more waiting than was originally expected. We're going to get more details here in New Orleans from the school district later today about their plans for rollout, but they've partnered with LCMC Children's Hospital, where they vaccinated school nurses last month, and they have a pretty good setup there. And, you know, we've seen kind of similar things throughout the state, whether it's school districts partnering with hospitals or local pharmacies to really kind of get teachers priority access. At the same time, teachers don't have to go through their employer. You know, they can go to a pharmacy, they can call 311 here in New Orleans. There are all sorts of avenues. And I know of plenty of teachers who have already secured appointments without going through the school district.
And Aubrey, we've heard about the vaccine hesitancy in other industries. Is there any sense that there might be any large portion of teachers that are hesitant to get the vaccine?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing things that suggest there, you know, is a number of teachers. You know, teachers are hesitant in some cases. Now, the majority of teachers are very enthusiastic. They've wanted to get vaccinated for a long time. They're very excited for this moment. But there are teachers who are a little nervous, want to hold back and wait. So as I said before, you know, early surveys here show that, you know, a little bit more than 60% want to get that vaccine right away. We saw similar numbers with school nurses, you know, 60%-ish getting the vaccine right away. That doesn't mean people aren't going to want to get it next month, the month after. And the district here has been having lots of town halls to really give educators an opportunity to ask questions, you know, dispel any fake news, any rumors about the vaccine, and really stress that, you know, this is a safe vaccine by all medical standards and encouraging teachers to go get the vaccine, you know, but wanting them to feel comfortable with that decision.
Great. And Aubrey, just last question on this part of the rollout. This does not include college and university educators, correct?
It doesn't. So there were some early proposals that, you know, looked to include college educators, but what it ultimately came down to it, the governor's order did not include those educators. And we know a lot of colleges, they have a little bit more wiggle room when it comes to doing distance learning, that older students can handle it better. And therefore, it really wasn't a surprise that priority has been given to these, you know, younger educators.
Great. Thank you, Aubrey. And Paul, what else can we expect this week from the governor and this rollout?
Well, on top of all the educators that we've been talking about here, Edwards also extended vaccine eligibility to people between the ages of 55 and 64 with a variety of medical conditions that put them at greater risk from COVID-19. There's about a dozen conditions, things like cancer, chronic kidney disease, Down syndrome, obesity, things that are really quite prevalent in Louisiana's population. We're talking about 300,000 people qualify for the vaccines under those criteria. They're also being extended to pregnant women of any age. And for anybody who fits into these categories, basically all they have to do to set up the appointment and bring to the appointment is an attestation form, basically signing and saying that, yes, I have one of these conditions that qualify me for vaccination.
Great. Well, thank you, Paul Braun, and thank you, Aubrey Uhas. Thanks for being here, guys.
Happy to do it.
No problem.
That's WWNO education reporter Aubrey Uhas and WRKF Capital Access reporter Paul Braun. And you've been listening to the Politics Round. I'm sorry, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered here on WWNO and WRKF. And I'm Patrick Madden. And that wraps up our show. And we want to thank everyone who appeared today, the advocates Blake Patterson and Jeff Asher. And of course, we want to thank Aubrey Uhas and Paul Braun. This episode will be up on our websites, WWNO.org and WRKF.org, shortly. And we'll be back tomorrow with Karen Henderson hosting from Baton Rouge. Thanks to our engineers, Garrett Pittman, Adam Voss, and our producer, Alana Klein. I'm Patrick Madden, and thank you for joining us.